You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Joining me from, I think, as I said, I think from Massachusetts. Got on my radar from a guy that everybody who listens to All Marine Radio knows, and that is Bob Nielsen. Bob is a great friend, and Patrick said just a few seconds ago, he has a great way of connecting people, and he's done that here. Patrick, so we were talking, Bob mentioned an article written in the Boston Globe by a guy that he knew, and he said, you should read this thing, and he was pissed. And I said, okay, send me the link. And it was a link about how the Boston, is it Athletic Association, doesn't promote competition for disabled riders. Patrick then wrote an article, which is what I got sent. So he joins us now. Patrick, first of all, thanks for coming on All Marine Radio and being a guest here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Bob's told me a lot about it, and I've listened to a couple of your episodes, and I think it's great that Marines are listening to each other. I should mention that I am currently talking to you from Walter Reed. I'd like to say that I was talking to you from Massachusetts to incite some of your anger towards Bostonians, which I intend to change at some point. But I'm calling you from Walter Reed this time.
So you were mentally prepared to come on the program.
Absolutely. I mean, once I heard those kind of fighting words about my hometown, I was ready to do something. And I would like to propose to you that at next year's Patriots Day, Marathon Monday, that you do a live radio broadcast from the marathon.
Never.
You can cheer on some of your fellow Marines and we can change.
I would do that. But I have so much hate inside of me for the way they treated my dad. It's a personal thing. Right? I mean.
Really? What did they do to your father?
They ran him out of town, treated him like garbage, people have never heard this story. Everybody now knows what a lying piece of garbage Roger Clemens is, right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and I know this, I know this from being in radio. Truth is defense in libel. Okay?
Mm.
They lose the World Series. Peter Gammons, and if you grew up in Boston, you know Peter Gammons.
Absolutely.
He's like, come on, he's like, the apostles, wrote the New Testament. Peter Gammons writes everything else. Anyway, Gammons writes an article in Sports Illustrated how my dad lost the World Series by taking Roger Clemens out of the sixth game.
Wait a second, your dad was
McNamara? Yeah, so now you understand the hate, okay?
Oh, wow. This does run deep.
Exactly. So, look, I'll be happy to come and broadcast, but that's probably not going to change. And so what Gammons wrote was a lie that Clemens promoted.
Wow.
My dad comes off the field in the, I want to say, after the end of the sixth inning. Clemens, as he does always, goes down in the tunnel when he's pitching. Pitching coach goes down and talks to him, comes up against my dad and says, you need to talk to Roger. And my dad goes down there. He says, "What's going on?" He says, "I'm out of gas. I'm running out of gas." He says, "I've got a start of a blister on my finger. I've been fighting a cold, and I'm out of gas." And my dad said, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Yeah." Now it's not a big deal till history intervenes, and
right.
And so, anyway. They lose the game. Gammons writes a story. My dad, like, does not deal with the media very well. So he takes on Gammons, which is, again, like taking on St. Peter. The problem is Gammons was told a lie and he printed it. And the truth was that, and Clemens said this, I didn't take myself out of that game. No, you didn't. He took you out of the game. What you told him was you were out of gas. And because the night that happened, I was at the game, right? And if you ever have anything like that happen, you really don't want to have it happen in New York City. Okay, Kansas City, Minneapolis, where the people are really nice. New York City, losing as a Red Sox fan. Oh, my God. It was awful.
Yeah.
So... I get back to, we get back to the hotel, and, you know, I see my dad, and I'm like, why did you take Clemens out? And he said, now this is before any of this has become a controversy. I didn't take Clemens out. I didn't take Clemens out. I said, what happened? And so he tells me the story before it's even a controversy. Then they lose game seven, and the rest is history. Well, what happens when he takes Gammons on, when he writes the Sports Illustrated article, is my dad is just drugged through the street by all Gammons' little minions, you know, Dan Shaughnessy and all these other, you know, little, you know, these little chinless bozos who write about what other people do and never really do anything themselves. That's their legacy. Not that I'm jaded, mind you.
You should keep in mind that we Red Sox fans were in a very bad place at that time, and that we have turned the page on history thanks to a number of World Series championships. And so it might be time to revisit some of these instances. Uh-oh. You know, we crucified Bill Buckner. Bill Buckner's a Hall of Famer, a great guy, and we drove him out of town, which is just horrific to him and his family. And perhaps we need to come to terms with how we treated your father and rewrite history to reflect the truth.
Yeah, but that's gets a little bit awkward for people. It's a little bit awkward for people. When the Yankees won the World Series, you know who was on the field hugging Roger Clemens? Peter Gammons.
Peter Gammons? Oh, boy.
Peter Gammons. And Roger Clemens, I mean, talk about now. So, and I'll tell you, a player on the Red Sox went up to Clemens in the outfield when my dad was getting annihilated, and he said, why don't you just tell the truth? And Clemens told him, wait a minute, you think that I won the Cy Young Award and the MVP, and I'm going to tell people that I took myself out of that game?
Yeah, right.
I'm not, you know, and again, you know, when Roger Clemens was Jack Armstrong, but, you know, in the light of history, in the long light of history, we now know that he's not Jack Armstrong.
Yeah.
He's a guy who struggles with deep character issues, and he's been like that for a long time. He just masked it with a great right arm and, a gift from God. So anyway, so Patrick, first of all, I want to wish you all the best of luck in changing that. But yeah, that's the story. And then, you know, and then so years go by and years go by. And I'll tell you what, I'm in Iraq in 2004, and I'm here's who I'm serving with. John Kelly's the assistant division commander, right? Currently the secretary of Homeland Security. He's from Baston. Joe Dunford is the chief of staff. He's from Baston. And
Boston.
Our sergeant major is from Boston. Okay. So they're all in Iraq, and now the Red Sox come back on the Yankees. Oh my God. And it was every day. And the sad part was though, with the jubilation of the entire Red Sox nation, my thought was, you know what? That should have belonged to my dad. You know what I mean? That history, you know, much like God said to Moses, you will look into the promised land, you will never set foot in that thing. And he didn't.
Yeah.
My dad had a similar experience. And so it was, I remember watching just how crazy Boston went. And I just remember just being, you know, sad because of the way Bill Buckner had been treated, because the way my dad had been treated, and I thought it was so wrong. It was so wrong. It's even colored the way I do radio. I tend to be really respectful and balanced, because when you have a pulpit like this, if you decide to, you can burn it down on somebody, and you can be disrespectful and condescending and just do it all the time just because you want to. And I learned that was probably not a good thing to do and was wrong. And so anyway, not that this is an issue for me.
Yeah.
I didn't realize
what I was up to.
Exactly. Way to light off Mount Vesuvius there. Anyway, we could continue our therapy session here.
Right. I do have a doctorate in psychology, so I have somewhat of a training background to be able to help with some of these things.
I love that. I love that. Maybe we could work on it. Tell me, so first off, Patrick, we have to find out about you now that we've had the first part of our therapy session.
Right.
First of all, you born and raised where?
Born and raised in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the People's Republic, which is right next to Boston and is obviously known for being the home of MIT and Harvard.
So everybody knows, hence the name the People's Republic, because there's more than one liberal out there in that little cluster of humanity.
Correct. Yes, it's a very special enclave, which we all take great pride in.
Exactly.
And I grew up in the same house my father grew up in.
No way.
My mom's from just south of the city, and they both taught and worked at Cambridge French and Latin, the public high school in Cambridge, and met there and fell in love, and so our family's been there for a long time, hence my strong affiliation with the Red Sox. And as a kid, I always grew up watching the Boston Marathon, or even listen to it on the radio, which, as I've said to some people before, like, there's nothing more boring than listening to a marathon on the radio, but you felt such a connection with the day and the celebration that you wanted to be in on it somehow. And as I went to Boston College High School and then to Boston College, so that makes me a double legal.
Oh my God.
Classification,
listen to this. We're not going to get along. I grew up in California. I get off active duty in 94. I move up to North Dakota in 1998.
Really?
Yeah. And so, the University of North Dakota is in the same city. I wound up going into broadcasting, meeting all those guys. The University of North Dakota and Boston College, have one of the great sports rivalries in hockey. They meet, it seems like, all the time, and they played for national championships. They played in playoffs. It's a great rivalry. So
absolutely, it's a huge rivalry. Now, does it help at all that my wife is from California?
Yes, it does. Not very much, but it helps it helps a little bit. So you get out of college and where do you go? What do you do professionally?
I moved down to D.C. I interned for Jim McGovern, congressman from Worcester, Massachusetts, and worked at Georgetown Prep, which is a Jesuit high school just down the street from Walter Reed. And being on Capitol Hill, my wife Jessica had moved from Sacramento, and she was interning for Doris Matsui, congresswoman from Sacramento.
Right.
And through those connections, that's how we met on Capitol Hill and through some mutual friends, and was our first connection to this area before coming back here in a much different context a number of years later. Eventually, my wife went to nursing school at Johns Hopkins, worked there for a while, and then moved up to Boston where I was in grad school for psychology, and we were married in 2012. We had both run the Boston Marathon in 2005. I was a senior at Boston College, and she was running with a friend. And as a part of my graduate training, I got an internship at University of California, San Francisco, and we were supposed to move there and likely settle there because her family was just a couple hours away in Sacramento. And so we wanted to go to the
marathon. Hold on. That's my hometown. Yeah. That's my hometown. What part of Sacramento?
She's in Gold River.
I don't even know what that is.
Rancho Cordova area.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I know what that is.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that's right near where you grew up?
Born and raised in Sacramento, California.
How about that?
Yeah. So you're digging yourself out of the hole so far. So don't screw it up here.
I should also say that after interning for Jim McGovern, I then worked for Doris Matsui, your congressman.
Right.
I did serve your community.
You know what? We love you for that, by the way. Did you do anything good, or did you screw it up like the rest of these bozos that are back there? Are you part of the solution or part of the problem?
Well, I didn't really have the pay grade to be a part of the solution. I was a staff assistant, so I did a lot of the very basic jobs around the office. Of course, in my naivete, I also screwed up a couple of things along the way, but those thankfully didn't do any harm to the fine people of Sacramento.
All right.
But we've stayed close friends with Doris Matsui and our friend Sam Stefanke, who's a big that cowboy still works for her. But anyway, so we knew we were headed back to California, and we wanted to go to the marathon one last time, just because it's in Boston, it's the best party day of the year. Everyone's been hibernating all winter, and
yeah,
finally get to come outside.
Explain Patriots Day. And I mean, the Red Sox play in the morning, essentially.
Right.
They play their earliest start of the season on Patriots Day so that they can get out of the way for the marathon. And it's this huge celebration in Boston. It's a citywide celebration in Boston.
It is. You don't go to school. A lot of people don't go to work. And it's just, you know, it's Patriots Day. It's celebrating the beginning of our independence in terms of the battles of Lexington and Concord and all of the many historical events that stem from that day. So it commemorates that battle. It's the day that the marathon is run on. The Sox play early. People are out of school, out of work. And so your jobs are either to go to the Sox game, be a spectator along the course, or run or race in the damn thing. So those are three things. That's all you're supposed to do that day. And that's what everyone does. And it just makes for this great party day. Lots of good food, lots of good beer, lots of good music. And you just hang out with people you know, but also total strangers. And you're all there to help make sure people finish 26.2 miles.
Now, let me just tell people, and this is, this approach is cult-like, how do I say this? It approaches cult-like significance because, this is how you get raised in Massachusetts. When you go to Fenway Park the first time, it's like going to the Vatican. If you're a little kid, you're going, your dad's going, your grandfather's going, your uncles are going, because you're going to the Mecca of baseball, right? The greatest, and when you look at the stadium, when you're walking up the steps, it's been there so long, you can see where the concrete has worn in the center of the step. It's a little bit eroded, because it's been generation after, and so that's how deep this kind of tradition of Patriots Day is, and what it means to the people of New England and Boston in particular. So,
absolutely. You're exactly right.
So take us to, 2013.
So my wife and I, she took the day off from her job as an oncology nurse at Mass General. And I had taken the day off from my internship at Tufts Medical Center. And we took the T from our apartment in Harvard Square into Boston and got off on Park Street and walked through the Boston Common and the Boston Public Gardens, which is where I had proposed to Jess. So it was like kind of like a farewell in many ways to the city that had meant so much to our relationship and certainly so much to me as a kid. And we ended up down by the finish line. We weren't there to cheer on any particular athlete. We just wanted to be a part of the celebration, as many people do. And then everything changed. We were at the site of the first bomb, which is the one closest to the finish line. And then a few seconds later, a second bomb went off. I have no recollection. I have some snapshots of that day before the bombs went off, but nothing from the time that the bomb went off. My wife, on the other hand, had went into this hyper-alert state and even had the presence of mind to try to tie her purse strap around my leg because it was very clearly severed.
Patrick, how close are – this is going to be kind of an different interview because our tribe, we don't shy away from amputees, okay? They're part of our tribe. So how close are you they put it in either next to or in a trash can, right?
It was in a backpack and it was put down on the ground. What we think is like 2 to 3 feet, behind us and to our left.
Okay. So just left on the ground. So you're 2 to 3 feet away from it. And obviously, unlike ours, it's above ground. Okay.
Correct.
All right. Now, in the blast, you and your wife, Jess, are both wounded, right?
Right. She was behind me, kind of using my shoulders to see up over the crowd. So she ended up being closer to the bomb and really shielding me from most of its blast. So at that moment, both of our left legs below the knee were amputated dramatically, and she suffered really bad damage to her right leg.
Okay.
Her Achilles was blown off, her heel, and her back was on fire. So she had all that going on and still kind of was in this mode to protect me and try to tie the tourniquet around my leg, which is what thankfully so many people did at that scene. Thanks, frankly, to many veterans and active duty service members who just had that instinct, because you guys have that training for many combat deployments.
Right.
And is the reason why so many people live that day.
Wow, wow, wow. And that starts your journey to, how do you get to Walter Reed for the first time?
So after about a year and a half of exploring options in the civilian medical world, we just couldn't find a good solution for my wife's right leg. We're trying to figure out, does she save it or is it time to amputate it? And her sister, Sarah, was doing an internship here in the MAPC at Walter Reed, and was meeting all these guys whose injuries are very similar to her sister's. And she said, you know, I don't know how you guys get here, but this is the best place in the world for amputee care. And so we started exploring that possibility and talking to a lot of politicians who had offered their resources when we were first in the hospital. And we had to get secretarial designee status. So the Secretary of Defense had to approve the fact that we needed this type of care and that we had exhausted our civilian options. And it's been one of the greatest gifts of our lot. In fact, my wife sometimes says that it's been more life-changing than the bombing itself, because it's given us this incredible opportunity to befriend so many incredibly special people and learn about the military in ways that we just never would have before. We're both civilians, never served a day in our lives.
Right.
We had some family members. I have a dear uncle, Bill Downs, who's United States Marines, Vietnam, and other distant relatives, but never a personal experience. And frankly, as a Bostonian, I equated war with military. So if I hated the war, I hated the military. And realized the experience here that was such a naive understanding of how all this works. And that military are people, really dedicated people, who not only love our country, but love each other and will do anything to care for each other. And we were greeted that way. I was afraid that someone was going to bring me out to the back of base and rough me up a little bit as a civilian coming from the Northeast.
Well, you don't come from the Northeast. You come from the People's Republic, too. I mean, come on. You got that in you. You got that in you.
That's right.
No. Keep going, Patrick. Patrick, let me just tell you, that's what we're privileged to know and live. I mean, what you got a glimpse of is how they behave in combat. And if you can imagine, instead of one explosion, machine guns and all kinds of craziness going on, and then behaving in the exact same manner, and then losing their friends, and then going out and doing it the next day the same way. And in that organization, those guys call me sir. Like, come on, are you kidding?
Right.
That's a joke. As you've experienced, it's one of the most humbling experiences you could ever have.
It is.
You could ever
it
have.
It is. I mean, I can't even fathom what that's like. And frankly, I get the chills just as you describe it, because, people hear what we went through in Boston and wonder about our traumatic response and the anxiety it must incite in us. And that's true to some extent, but that's nothing compared to the constant, fear and danger and threat that you guys face every time you go outside the wire, and the commitment that you have to the person next to you. You know, you have a survival instinct for yourself, but your drive to keep the guy next to you alive is even stronger. And we've spent the last couple of years reflecting on that and what that says about who you all are and how you embody a lot of the traits that we hope to instill in our children in our community. You know, this sense of duty, sense of responsibility, sense of pride, sense of altruism. And that stuff is lived in a very real way when you talk to a lot of these guys. And then to see the injuries that they've sustained and still their commitment to one another, and then to welcome us into that group is really nothing short of extraordinary.
Pretty amazing. My guest today, yeah. Patrick Downs, and you're hearing him describe his career and his path to Walter Reed, and then having a second life-changing experience relative to that. So the comeback from injuries like that is a long comeback, Patrick. So I've got to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about you're getting involved again in a different way in the marathon, and then ultimately the article you wrote, and then I know there's been some progress made, so I want to talk about that. As much as I would really enjoy painting something Bostonian in a bad light, I think they're making even the fools among us can make progress. So we'll talk about all that. My guest today is Patrick Downs, whose wife comes from my hometown of Sacramento, so I'm being nice to him. And we're talking about an article he wrote that talked about inclusion of the bravest of the brave on a day when New England honors its patriots. So we're going to talk more about that. Patrick, first of all, great having you on, honestly, and I hope we will continue to do these things and whenever you want to or whenever you got something to say. So hold on.
Thanks very much.
No, not a problem, man. We're going to take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
. 7:52 on a Wednesday hump day across the United States. It is 10:52 on the East Coast, and my guest, Patrick Downs, is on the East Coast in the Washington, D.C. area, and he joins us this morning. So, Patrick, talk about, explain to everybody how, you, in the process of your healing, where are you today? So, physically, where are you at today, and physically, where is your wife?
Physically, I'm doing really well. I've been doing well for a while. 6 months after the bombing, I had a big revision on my residual limb, and that set me up for a lot of success. My wife, on the other hand, has had a really hard time. She's had a number of infections, failed surgeries, falls, complications that have just dragged up the recovery for a really long time physically, and obviously that takes a significant psychological toll as well. We're hoping that we can wrap up our time at Walter Reed and get back to Boston sometime soon, just because you got to keep moving somehow. This is an incredible resource to be here, but, as many of our friends have shown us before us, that sometimes you just got to jump back into the world. And that doesn't mean you totally give up on your rehab, but you just do it in a slightly different way. And we're hoping that we can get to that place sometime soon.
All right. You know, that's part of this that, you know, we talk about all the time. Again, you and her are part of our tribe these days. But the mental part associated with all of this is not an easy piece. And
no.
And when you,
I think it's harder. It's harder in a lot of ways. I mean,
no, you're right.
your body is drastically changed, and at Walter Reed, they call me a paper cut. If you're a single baloney amputee, they're like, you know, what's the big deal, buddy? And relatively speaking, they're absolutely right, because I know, but
Patrick, how how jacked up is that, right? Here, like, everywhere you go, right, people are like, oh, hey.
Right.
And then you get to Walter Reed, and they're looking at you like, what's up, pussy boy?
Right.
What, when you get a real injury, why don't you come back and talk to us, right?
I was carrying Jason crutches one day through the Massey, and some of the guys said, oh, Patrick, you have a boo-boo? So I never carried the crutches again. You don't do that. And they're right.
That's awesome, though.
They're right.
Well, Patrick, you know, the first thing is you live, right?
Right.
You live.
Absolutely.
And I had a guy, hell, you may know him, Pat Horan, gunshot wound to the head.
Yes.
And you know, he told me the other day, he said, well, the first thing I do is I get up every morning and I thank God that I'm alive.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow. I get to walk on the same planet as that guy. You know, what the hell? But that's hilarious.
And that's peculiarly on our mind, because four people died in Boston.
Right.
And their families would kill for them to have a bad day or to be sad or to have a little bit of pain, because it means that they're alive. And I know that that's a sense that's shared by a Wounded Warrior brothers and sisters here, because they know plenty of people who did not come back.
Right.
And I think that despite their injuries, they say, I feel so grateful to be alive. As hard as that is sometimes, that doesn't mean that everything is easy, because of the fact that you're alive. Sometimes it can feel overwhelmingly difficult. And that's why the mental health piece is so important in my life, and I really invest in that, both individual therapy, couples therapy. Just being here in the Massey at Walter Reed is therapy. Just be among all these really special people who can relate in some way. You can't make that stuff up. And it's strange. We are unlucky to have such a big group of amputees in Boston, 17 from the bombing. But in another way, you know, we have that built-in support group of a lot of people around our age, who are going through the same things we're going through.
You know, it's interesting. You know, you've got a chance to look behind the curtain that, you know, that not many get to look behind, Patrick, in terms of
right.
not only your injury, but also the place where you were, you know, you were accepted to rehab, and really the journey that you've gone on. That all sets the stage for you to kind of cross paths in your article with the Boston Athletic Association. But you've looked behind the curtain and you've seen what moves us so much, in our culture. And I tell you, you've been honored to be, you know, accepted into that culture and be able to see it. And the things you say are not the things that normal human beings say, cause you've seen a different part of life. Talk to us about how that affected you, and give everybody the state of the Boston Marathon, before this last run.
Sure. So 5 days after the bombing, five Marines came into our room, my room, at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And they had all types of war injuries. And they said to me, life is still possible. Running is still possible. Skiing is still possible. All the things that you think are impossible are still possible. And that was the first gift that they gave to me and my family. And with the first sign that we were now going to be lifelong friends with these people who we probably would never have crossed paths with. And that continued here at Walter Reed. And you're right, we have been able to see in a very intimate way what this is like and who these people are made of. And that brings with it a sense of responsibility, that I am not in a position to go to battle with you guys. Nor can I ever, pretend that, I will share that experience with you. And yet at the same time, perhaps I have a responsibility as a civilian to translate what this experience has been like to make other civilians aware of how special this place is, how special the people who make up this place is. And what we found in Boston was that hand cyclists were not welcome at the race. There was a small field size of about 12 hand cyclists. They were given really short shrift. They were given the bottom of the barrel in terms of resources and no acknowledgement for any of their accomplishments. And
let me stop you there. I did this with the U.S. women's hockey team when I heard that, you know, the men fly in business.
I heard you talking about this.
Right, the men fly in business class, the women fly in coach. The men can bring a guest, the women can't. The men stay one to a room, the women team up. You know, and all this, it's like, who does that make sense to? So when they're talking about including anybody with a disability, who did it make sense to, Patrick, that they would be treated in a different way in the 21st century, for God's sake?
To common sense people, I have no clue. But what I've gathered is that they see it as a very traditional race, an old, prestigious race in not only our country but in the world. So that it's a race supposed to be done with your feet. But not all of us have feet, or not all of us have feet that work.
Right.
And that's a wonderful advancement in medical technology, that people such as myself and our Wounded Warrior brothers and sisters are able to still be alive. But then we as a society have to change with it and be more inclusive to people who just look.
But we have been. What the hell happened to the Boston Marathon?
I don't know.
As you point out, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but I will a little bit. As you point out, the Marine Corps Marathon, 84, I think was the number. The LA Marathon in the 40s, the New York Marathon in the 60s, and the Boston Marathon run on Patriots Day in the 20s. You see those numbers and you're like, holy smokes, who the hell, where are these? And me, I looked at it, right, and I said, go figure, right? Those morons from Boston at it again.
Right.
So I'm just curious. So you write your article, and how was it received?
After many years of diplomacy, I tend to be a more diplomatic person. I want to talk things out. I feel like we can get more accomplished with honey than anything else. And so I did my best.
You didn't learn that in Walter Reed, I can tell you that.
My wife, on the other hand, is far more aggressive. She said, "Patrick, you're being too nice.
Right.
You've got to light a fire underneath them."
Yeah, because we'll straight up burn it down on them.
What's that?
We'll straight up burn it down on them.
Exactly.
Right? We don't care.
Exactly. And we were making incremental progress through those discussions. But it was not on the top of their priority list by any means. And I kept thinking and saying to them, listen, all I got to do is write an op-ed to the Boston Globe and take this to the court of public, and you guys are smoked. No way in the world that the public, military or civilian, would have any patience for this type of exclusion. And sure enough, that's what happened, that I had the privilege of being able to have the platform to write a letter like that and get it placed in Boston Globe and then let people talk and process it. And not only as, to the credit of Boston and Massachusetts, the groundswell of support for veterans and people with disabilities was enormous.
Yeah, that's why it's such a dichotomy. When you read it, you're like, what?
Right.
And those that have raced, they haven't had their names announced or their times announced. Like,
yeah.
What is this, Jim Crow, for God's sakes? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. And I heard your conversation with Bill the other day,
uh-oh,
making some of these comparisons. And I do think that when you look at any kind of civil rights movement, that, you know, the stories are obviously very different. The exclusions are very different. The hatred's very different, but there are a lot of similar themes, and there are a lot of similar excuses about why people shouldn't be seen as equal. And you would think that we would have learned from history and realized that those excuses never hold up over the course of history, and that including people and recognizing all people for being human and acknowledging their dignity is what eventually happens over the course of history. And so we just needed to accelerate that process by getting the public involved. Because as many people said to me, Patrick, we just didn't know that this was an issue. We would have been saying something before. We just didn't know about it. And so in some ways, I wish I didn't have to write an op-ed, but in other ways, perhaps it's beneficial because not only did it change things faster, hopefully it put just these topics, these themes out there for us to create other change at other marathons around the country or just about how we think that we're going to take care of our veterans, how we think we're going to be welcoming to people with disabilities.
And
it's not a race, but it's about a lot, something much bigger than that, too.
And truth be told, it's not just about our veterans either. There's a whole
right.
class of people, there's a whole class of people like you, like your wife, who need these things in their life, who absolutely positively need these things in their life to make their lives more complete. And so, so they're not sitting at home all day watching television and living that life that nobody wants to live. So,
no, because you don't just go out and ride the marathon on Patriots Day. You train for it. You do other marathons. You're working out hard in the
right.
gym. You have this goal that you're striving toward. And then you get out there and thousands of people are cheering you on as you're pushing your body to its limits, regardless of what access you have to all the body parts that are still attached to you. And that is something that's just incredible. So this year, not only did we get these some of these changes done, they agreed to acknowledge the winner at the end with a ceremony, playing of the national anthem. Our dear friend Tom Davis, Army single amputee above the knee was champion. He's a beast. He wins these things all the time, but won it in 58 minutes, which bested his Boston time by like 15, 20 minutes. The whole team was fired up.
We're so piss testing that dude. All right, what's going on with that? Look,
yeah.
Jay, just because you're an amputee doesn't mean we're not going to call bullshit when you like knock off that much time off your off your time. So we're gonna
It's amazing what pride can do.
No,
pride can fuel you in ways that drugs cannot.
Well, I'll tell you what, and the adrenaline of that marathon, that special day, and participating in it.
Right, and we also did some other changes like. Making sure that when the guys load the bus from their hotel, that they can stay on that bus all the way to the start line before they'd have to get off the bus. Some of them have all their medical equipment, so they'd have to get the wheelchair and crutches off. Some of them leave that behind at the hotel because there's a lot to lug around on a day that's got a lot of moving pieces. So that, you know, makes things comfortable and safer for them. And a number of other changes that we think are really important, including doubling the field size for the hand cyclists for next year, which will be a really profound statement about how this class of athletes are going to be welcomed as a legitimate division of the Boston Marathon.
Okay, now, here's what I think doubling is okay, but that gets you on par with the LA Marathon, which is the third. Is the third. Why isn't the premier marathon? Why doesn't it have the, you know, as many, should have the most people given its stature? So is there a plan to get you, to get that marathon? And I should probably talk to your wife and not you, but because she'll burn it down on them. Is there a plan to get on par with the Marine Corps Marathon so they say we're the premier marathon event in the world for everybody, that inclusion exists?
Yes.
There is a plan.
Yes, yeah, So the goal for next year to double the field size. They have a number of concerns about logistics and safety. They are lacking in specificity when it comes to those concerns, but we won't hear them out.
Hey, Patrick, just say, talk to the Marines. They'll help you figure it out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, it's not like we just made this up yesterday.
Right.
You know, we've been working with Achilles International, which is a fantastic nonprofit out of New York, which makes all these marathons possible, not only for veterans, but for civilians with disabilities as well. And they are experts at this stuff. And they're like, you show us where your problems are, we'll help you fix it. And then with the goal of smashing and then surpassing New York. That was what we kind of dangled in front of them because, as you know, Boston and New York have this pretty strong rivalry.
A little bit.
And so we thought that would help light a fire underneath them. And I've gotten that assurance that they're going to work toward that. So now we just have to, and we saw a number of these things actually get implemented this year. And then we got to keep the momentum going next year and beyond.
Interesting. My guest today, Patrick Downs, email for you. Hey, Patrick. Hey, Mac. What is Patrick doing now?
Well, that's a good question. I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing now.
That's not uncommon after these kind of events, right? I mean, it takes a while to figure it out again. So what are you doing there, Patrick?
Well, I love this whole kind of social problem solving piece. I know that sounds a little abstract, but I love being able to see some of these problems and bring really thoughtful, smart people together to help fix them. I don't want to run for office. I feel like that's like just a waste of time and energy and money in a lot of ways. But I love the idea of governing because you have this platform to bring people together. So I thought about philanthropy. I thought about, you know, there are some really cool organizations in Boston whose purpose is to solve social problems. They raise a bunch of money and then they go after, helping inner city kids, helping people with disabilities, integrating veterans into the community and the workforce. All that stuff gets me really jazzed up. And while it's not a traditional use for a doctorate in psychology, I see the world very psychologically. And I think that it's important because you first have to acknowledge the human dignity in people. And once you do that, I think solving problems to include them in society don't seem as difficult.
Okay. What about, so you're going to run for office? And that's
it. No. No, I'm not. I'm afraid to run for office. I feel like I could ask. First of all, I'm terrible at raising money. Second of all, I'd be terrible at raising money for myself as opposed to a cause. And third of all, it's not the best quality of life. You're at campaign events all the time because the nature is that you have to raise money constantly.
Right.
And so you're not with your wife or your family or, chilling in your backyard, just, hanging out. And I enjoy doing all those things. But at the same time, want a job that has purpose and meaning and contributes back to society.
Okay. I ran for office. I ran for office once and served, and I didn't particularly care for it. Because I think
what
that,
level?
Just local city council stuff, and I was disappointed, and maybe it's probably my Boy Scout kind of nature and my belief reinforced by the Marine Corps in what's right is important, and so. What I would tell you is, the truth isn't important, and that bothered the hell out of me. I don't mind intellectually engaging, and fighting for maybe philosophical points or political points.
Absolutely.
But to me, the system at the end of the day ought to come together and it ought to push the ball further down the road. Now that means you can't always have it your way. I got it. But when we don't serve the nation's needs and compromise at the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
we fail the guys that you've met at Walter
right.
Reed. We fail people
right.
like you and your wife. We fail all kinds of people across the country who need better health care and a better health care program. And so it's so sad to watch this. And so when you're trying to get there and somebody doesn't like a point, they just discount your whole study. Oh no, that's
correct.
And you're like, wait a minute. That's anyway. So
right. No, I agree. And we've learned a lot about that by being here. We are friends with people on the total other end of the political spectrum from us. And yet we find so much common ground because we can listen to each other and understand where each other are coming from and realize that we have a common goal in mind. And once you do that, then you can overcome a lot of that other BS in between.
My guest this morning is the one and only from the state, the great Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Patrick Downs. Patrick wrote an article critical of the Boston Athletic Association for its lack of inclusion for runners with is runners the appropriate word?
I say riders, racers. I say Patriots should ride and run on Patriots Day.
Okay. They would really, the Boston Marathon had the lowest number of disabled riders of all the major marathons. And so Patrick has brought to the nation's attention. And talk to us about how the Boston Athletic Association reacted to that, because that was national news. Patrick, were you surprised at the coverage that it got?
I knew that it would be big in Boston. I knew it would be big in the veteran community and disability community. I was hoping that it would get more attention than that. But I wasn't really aware of how national it was, because I was so kind of fired up about making something happen about it. And the initial reaction was kind of a damage control one about, all right, how do we, from the BAA's perspective, how do we fix this? And I said, well, before you fix anything, you have to make amends. You have to apologize for the way you treated these people and disrespected not only the athletes, but their families. You know, a lot of spouses and kids and parents are there for the race and see how disrespected their loved ones are and are crushed by it. And you have to acknowledge that and make amends. And to the VA's credit, they issued an apology, standalone apology, not like, I'm sorry, and then we're going to do this sort of thing to cover it up, but an apology that stood for itself. And I hope, particularly in this day and age where apologizing just to apologize doesn't happen all that often, I thought that it was an important statement. And then we could get down into the nitty-gritty about how to make the race better for these athletes. And I hope and I think it served as an acknowledgement to many of our dear friends that their feeling slighted was not imaginary. It was not something they cooked up in their heads, but was real. And they had every right to feel the way that they felt. And by the way, none of this is out of pity. Like, there's some people, some of the push room wheelchair athletes, which is a different division, have said that us asking for equal respect is us asking for pity. There was an op-ed that they put in the Globe, which, first of all, if you know any of these guys, you know that pity isn't even in their vocabulary. And
wait, hold on. So explain to it. Yeah. Who are the people that wrote this?
So there are two different ways to complete a marathon with wheels. One is the hand cycle, which is the preferred bid for a lot of the Wounded Warriors. And the other is push-rim wheelchair. And the push-rim wheelchair is very elite. They're incredibly athletic and has been like the more traditional way for completing a marathon with wheels. But for many combat-injured, blast trauma survivors, accessing those wheelchairs is not practical, as it requires putting pressure on parts of your body that have been blown up. The skin has been removed, muscles been removed, bowels, genitals, all those things, you know, in a very real way. And so, and not to mention the fact that some of these guys are missing an arm or two arms, and they still want to complete the race, and a push for them just isn't practical. But their contention was that by us trying to get more respect as hand cyclists in the marathon, that we were seeking, and that we were lowering the bar and lowering the standard for people with disabilities, which I just thought was such a baseless argument, not to mention the fact that at some point they, as push-rim athletes, had to make a similar argument to be included in what has always been known as a runner with 2 feet. And for them to not be aware or acknowledge that this is a similar fight for inclusion, I thought was incredibly short-sighted on their part.
You know, one of the interesting things about doing a show is that you come across these kind of disagreements and whatnot. I'll tell you another one, and this will blow you away. At a Memorial Day event, I was told by a widow that, you know, if your husband committed suicide, the widows of guys who were killed in combat treated you differently. You weren't accepted. Like, our husbands died as heroes. Your husbands came back and couldn't handle it. Our husbands never came back. And so,
yeah.
You know what? So and you hear these and you're like, oh man, stop, make it go away. You know, this, it's bad enough as it is. And then, and yet there's still, you know, people that have, disagreements. And I guess like any other organization. But yet it's in such an intimate, you know, place that we don't really talk about that kind of stuff in public. And yet it's real for a lot of people. And so
absolutely.
So have they made peace yet? Are they gonna have a fight? What's going on?
Well, I think there's some lasting and standing animosity and tension between the groups, which is really unfortunate because, as you point out, it's infighting. You know, we may have different experiences, we may have different minds and bodies, but we all have suffered from a life-changing disease or illness or tragic event or injury because of war. And we have to be able to respect those differences and at the same time acknowledge what's similar about all of us. You know, the soldier who's killed in action is a horrific death and incredibly sad for that family, as is the death by a soldier when he or she comes back stateside and takes their life. I mean, it clearly says something about the trauma that they've experienced. And we can acknowledge that both of those deaths are different, and yet at the same time are similar, and have to appreciate each family's perspective and experience of what that must be like. And so sometimes this comes down to a very elemental level of humans understanding other humans and putting aside whatever pride we might have or pretense and just seeing the other person for who they really are. Because once you do that, I really don't think that there's anything but respect. If I could really see who you are and appreciate your experience and your story and what makes you tick, how can I then come to a conclusion other than respect for you? I think that that's part of what we're hoping for, is that we can all respect where each person is coming from. And none of the hand cyclists are saying that they're better than the push rims or faster or more athletic. None of that.
Right.
We're racing against each other.
It's crazy.
Frankly, we're just racing against our own self to know that we have a sense of accomplishment and pride when we finished 26.2.
You know what? I didn't realize this because I never I never ran track. But you know, the thing in track is to run a personal best. Now it's great if that's any kind of meet record, if that's any kind of school record, but that's who you race. You race against yourself. And so it's interesting. Let me read you an email. Mac, what an interesting interview from a non-Marine. Who knew? Seriously, Patrick, what a great, great, great contribution. Congratulations to him. And just so you know, Patrick, you don't have to serve to be accepted in our tribe. It's really the pain and overcoming and the struggle that makes you part of the tribe. And we're happy to have you. I'm curious if Patrick is going to broaden this to other athletic events that don't embrace disabled riders as well. Patrick?
Well, first of all, that sentiment means a good deal to me, more than I have words to express. And I don't plan on this being the last time that I find some way to help a fellow brother or sister, because we really do see all of you in this way now, in an acceptable way. And the answer to the question is yes, we hope that there are some other cities out there who are not as inclusive to hand cyclists as they need to be. Not just as they should be, but they need to just do it. And we hope that this is somewhat of a warning shot to them, that they ought to take proactive steps to be more welcoming. But if they don't, we're going to find similar ways to rattle their cage in their cities. And because it's time has passed, that like we've already had, as we've mentioned before, we've already had these arguments about inclusion, and now we've got to act on them. I think this is one of many steps. My wife and I are also writing a children's book about our service dog, Rescue. He's a beautiful big black lab. He's got his own Instagram page, Rescue Boston, as we go through all our adventures in life. But we realize that people are fascinated by him and then fascinated by all our medical equipment, our prosthetics, our wheelchairs. And it's such a cool opportunity to teach people, particularly kids, about service dogs and people with disabilities. Because if we're able to teach this next generation about how unique or special or cool different bodies are and how normal it is, then we are able to change a lot of these mindsets, that we're not so entrenched in this idea that a human body has two arms, two legs, one head, and operates the way we all think it should. In fact, that the human body doesn't always look that way or operate that way. And so that has applications not only to these races, but how we make buildings more accessible to employees who have different needs, how we include them in advertising for TV shows. And this conversation sounds very similar to other civil rights pushes of the past, that once you start to include these people into the world, then we really demystify what it was that we thought was different about them in the first place. And that is a powerful work that creates change, and it's something that I hope to be a part of in some way.
All right. Patrick, first of all, I can't thank you enough for coming on. It's a pleasure meeting you. And
thank you. Same here.
No, yeah, your story is certainly a compelling one, as was the article, in terms of starting a chain of events that certainly has left a dent in a place where certainly that dent is very appropriate. Anytime that we can be of help, please don't hesitate. You know how to get a hold of me. And you know Nielsen, so anytime we can help, come on the program and let it rip. And all our stuff,
thank you.
In addition to being live, gets up on iTunes and Google Play Music and other podcast channels. And so it gets some decent coverage. And we'd love to be a part of whatever you're doing in any way that we can relative to helping. So good on you, man.
Thanks,
and I know
so
that
much,
yeah, no, I know that it's really weird that how something so terrible, such as losing a part of your body, can wind up maybe, as your wife said, being a blessing in disguise. Now, it's
mm-hmm.
The fact that people say that is sounds crazy, but you and I know a different reality. You in particular
yeah.
know it better than I do, but our tribe knows a different reality in terms of how lucky we're to live, and after getting ribbed for being on crutches,
yeah.
right? That is
right.
Let me tell you, I love that stuff because you know what? It's normal.
Yeah.
It's normal.
Sure is.
It's
yeah.
normal, and it makes
frankly,
you makes you getting your balls busted for being on crutches for guys that like are double amputees above the knees, and them laughing about it and making fun of you.
Right.
It's what you need.
Respect for each other.
Right.
And in a unique way, it's how we show respect for each other.
It's what you need, and it's what they need.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I really admire what you're doing, and wish you all the best, and hope that there is another opportunity for us to talk again.
We'll make one. We'll make one up.
Yeah.
We don't need an excuse. All right, bud. Thanks for the visit.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
You bet. That is Patrick Downs. If you go to, if you check us out on Facebook, you see the last thing we posted, which was the notification of the show this morning. You will see Patrick's, the article for Patrick's, and I'll go ahead and tweet it out, here in a little bit. So, what a good dude though. You know, and I'll tell you, it's one of the, it's the kind of story that I love, and, the reason that I love it is because they're not, they don't know our culture. They don't know our culture, and then they get brought into it, and they get brought into it, and it's nothing like they thought it was. And they have this incredible experience. Again, the bravest, the most selfless people on the planet. So we're going to take a quick break. I want to welcome a new sponsor, and it is the Marine Corps Mustang Association. Okay, so Ernest Johnson's the president. You've heard him on the program, and let me just read you their little blurb that will turn into a commercial here. The Marine Corps Mustang Association is comprised of Marine Corps officers and officers of other military services who share a common background. We're a group of men and women who initially enlisted and served with distinction in the Marine Corps and the Marine Corps Reserve enlisted ranks. The term, as used by the Navy and the Marine Corps of Mustang, refers to a commissioned or warrant officer who has risen from the enlisted ranks. In its proper sense, Mustang referred to the wild or half-wild horse of the American Plains, especially of Mexico and California, and was a distortion of the Spanish term, Mustango. The Marine Corps Mustang Association was conceptualized by Captain Robert E. Richter, United States Marine Corps retired, and formed and incorporated in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on 10 November 1985 as a nonprofit veteran service organization. This is their 33rd year of existence. The Mustang Association continues to dedicate itself to the advocacy of professional development and encouragement of younger Marines, demonstrating a pathway for advancement and offering mentoring, advice, and camaraderie over their military service and civilian careers. What do they want? They're looking for a few good men and women to join their association. Okay, you need to do that. It's a great one. They continue to award scholarship information and doing good things. So they're looking for a few good men and women. They want you, if you're a Mustang, to join them. You can contact them on their website, Marine Corps Mustang, MarineCorpsMustang.org, or you can just search that on Facebook, find their page, and like us there. So, the Marine Corps Mustang Association, welcome to the fold. More about Phil Smith's going to join us after this break on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Continue. My thanks to Patrick Downs for coming on. And that's a great story. So, and he's a good dude, even if he is from Boston. So, joining me now is a guy who's not from Boston. He's a Midwest guy, Phil Smith. He's been on the program before. So, Smitty, first of all, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back.
No. It's been too long. First of all, Phil Smith, Colonel, United States Marine Corps retired infantryman. He and I worked together at the Infantry Officer Course, where you've heard a number of people come on with that lineage. So he's a smart guy, even if he doesn't speak like one. I'm curious. You watched General Kelly do his thing. We knew General Kelly as a major. We were captains. Phil more senior than the rest of us, I think, for some reason. Certainly more grown up. And John Kelly's a funny guy, if you don't know that. And he's a smart guy. And he's got this kind of personality, this savvy and common sense, along with being a really, really, really smart guy that is, he points it all at leadership, and he does great stuff. And that's why he's been so successful. But there was a loop around Quantico where we worked, and the loop was like, what, 8 miles, Smitty?
I think almost 9.
So, yeah, he would know that because Phil ran it. Unlike me, I knew where the 3-mile turnaround was. That was as far as old Mac was going. So Kelly, he was not a marathoner either. He was a 3-mile guy. So in the summer in Quantico, it's like hot and humid. So he comes in and he's just drenched, sweating. And we're all working or doing something, and he walks in and plops down. And I don't think anybody paid attention to him, so he felt the need to call attention to himself. So he says, "Man, the lube's a bitch today." And with that, everybody stops and looks like, "What did you just say?"
Yeah.
And then he feigned indignity at us. Like, "What? Oh, you guys don't think I ran the loop? Is that what I'm getting? All you captains?" I'll tell you another funny one, Smitty. One of the funniest things I've ever seen in the chow hall anywhere. I became the staff sec for General Mattis in 2004 because of my previous relationship with General Kelly. So Mattis's aide got wounded, and they took the staff sec and made him the aide, and I was working in plans, and Kelly comes to me. We'd only been in Iraq maybe 45 days at that, and Kelly comes and he says, "I want you to be General Mattis's staff sec." I said, "I don't even know what that is." I said, I meant kind of feminine, right? I said, "It sounds kind of gay."
Yeah.
It sounds kind of gay to me. Certainly.
I
certainly wouldn't say that now. And he looks at me, he says, "It is kind of, but Mac, you'll do fine. I need a grown up." So he pays me this compliment, the only one he's ever paid me in my life. And then he says, I said, "Well, who do I work with? He said, "Well, you work for the CG and me, and you'll work with the chief of staff, Joe Dunford." And I said, "Who's Joe Dunford?" He looks at me, and he said, "He's some boss, and you'll love him." I went, "Oh my god!" But the three of us go to breakfast one morning, which is kind of odd because there was so much stuff going on, and work started really early. But anyway, we wind up at breakfast, and Dunford and I are sitting on one side of the table, and Kelly sitting across from us. And so Kelly stands up at the end. He says, "I got to get going." And he grabs his tray, and then he looks down, and he looks around, and he says, "Hey, anybody seen a pistol?" No, there's all these Marines. There's like, it's a chow hall, right? And so everybody's got their head down. There's a TV with, you know, the news on. People are kind of looking, and, you know, guys in small groups talking and stuff like that. And here's this tall guy stands up and says, "Hey, anybody seen a pistol?" And with that, everybody stops and looks and says, "Who is that?" And he looks around and goes, "It's right here. What do you think? I'm an idiot. Go back to eating." And with that, he walks out of the chow hall. And I almost spit whatever. I think I was eating cereal. I almost spit it across the room when he said it. But,
Very dry and deep sense of humor. He's a good guy all the way around.
Woody, give me your thoughts. He's got probably one of the toughest jobs, given the issues that he deals with. And you haven't seen the Department of Homeland Security in the news nearly as much as it could have been, to be honest with you. And just your thoughts about that.
I think he knows exactly what he's doing, and he knows how to either get the public attention that the department needs, or in the startup of an organization, you want to stay out of the limelight the best you can. So he knows how to do that as well. What's interesting to me is that he is basically, I think, serving. While he serves at the pleasure of the president, he knows exactly what the country needs with regards to illegal immigration and drugs. I've heard him talk several times about the problems of drugs coming up from the South when he was Southcom down there, and he is adamant that we can do something about it. So it's good to see that he's cracking down and is irrespective of any political blowback, which is one of the benefits, I think, of having military guys in an administration is, you know, they don't give a shit about the politics. They care deeply about the country and the issues that divide us, and they're trying to do the best they can. And Kelly, you know, he'll kill himself at this particular job, just, you know, going after it.
For people who haven't heard that little thing he does, he talked about the murder rate. He talked about the murder rate in the United States, and he talked about the murder rate in Honduras. And I want to say the murder. Let's just say the murder rate. The murder rate in the United States is five per 100,000. The murder rate in Honduras because of the drug trade is 90 per 100,000, right? Almost 20 times what it is in the United States because of the drug trade. And Kelly has seen all of that. And and we played his testimony to during his confirmation, and he went through all that. He was awesome, and you know, and I don't know. There's been a guy that's better qualified for that job, because he's not afraid, first of all. But his time in Southcom made him intimately familiar with the intelligence, the drug routes, the support, how they're moving drugs, how they innovate and continue to be able to move them with all the monetary resources that those cartels have. And so it's, I don't know, there's been a more prepared guy. And again, we're not, look, I know we're like rocking the boat in terms of the fan club stuff, but I honestly do believe that in terms of, you know, the guy prepared for that job and also that has the political savvy given his time on Capitol Hill, and a guy who has the personal skills, the people skills to navigate all that stuff, I think he uniquely qualified for that job.
Yeah, I agree. There's probably not a book out there on this topic that he hasn't read, which is another thing I think that's a bonus for him. I mean, regardless of what you think about physical or personal experience, if you don't have it, you get it by reading, and he certainly has that experience down in spades.
I went long. I just interviewed a guy who wrote a piece in the Boston Globe.
Yeah, I was on. I heard parts of it. That's pretty cool.
Isn't it? He talks about how his injury took him to a world that he knew nothing about, and now making a difference in the lives of other people. So interesting stuff. So I apologize for being late. Let's talk about your woodworking hobby.
Okay.
All right. Smitty, your entire life you've lived a purpose-driven life. How do you transition from that? How do you find purpose after you've retired? And how does woodworking fit into all that?
Well, I'm not sure that I found purpose in retirement yet. I think the woodworking thing here is something that I've always wanted to do, and it requires patience and time, not a lot of which I had, the 36 years while I was in the service moving around, so not the ability to acquire the tools or the skills, because it is a patient and time-driven hobby. But now that I've established a foothold here in South Carolina, I've got time to work on the skills that's required, purchase some of the tools that's necessary to make some decent furniture. So it's just kind of an in-between thing. It's a hobby that I've always wanted to do but never had the time to acquire the skill to get kind of good at it. So I really want to see if I can follow through with the hobby and perhaps maybe do something a little bit more substantial with it. I don't think I'll make furniture for sale or anything like that. But the patience that this hobby requires is amazing. You can't get out a sequence of the process that you're, you know, putting the furniture together, because if you do, you'll end up having to redo the thing. And that's something that I've always probably underappreciated, was sequencing and synchronization and those types of things in my military career. I always kind of poo-pooed them.
Right.
But it does pay off with regards to something like putting pieces of wood together and getting them ready for a finish.
My guest, Phil Smith, here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. And first of all, how do you get into woodworking? And if somebody, I mean, because there's guys who listen every day and are looking to do different things. Is it a hard thing to get into? Do you have all the fancy schmancy saws and miters and stuff like that?
Not fancy, but I've got enough of the tools that I need to do what my skill level permits. And I basically got into it because my dad did it, and I did it for a little bit in high school, working with him on weekends and things. He was a framer, a painter, did some concrete. So I was always interested in that. It runs in the family a little bit because my mom's two brothers were carpenters. My dad was a carpenter, so I think it's in our genes somewhere. But the tools that I have, I just have my dad's old benchtop planer. I've got a chop saw. I've got a big 20-inch bandsaw that's used to resaw wood into smaller pieces. I've got a router and a jointer, and that's basically all I've got, a bunch of chisels and sandpaper.
What's a jointer?
A jointer is a rotary head that it comes from 6 inches wide. You can get them up to 18 or 20 inches wide, that basically has a flat fence that's used to square and joint an edge. Before you cut a piece of wood to length or to width, it has to be square at least on two sides. So the way that you get one side of your piece of wood square is you run it across a jointer, and you know that edge is going to be flat. So then when you put it through a table saw, you put that flat edge up against the fence, so it's then going to cut your width or your length and whatever you're doing exactly square.
Got it. Phil Smith. So in this whole hobby thing, I mean, how many hours of the day can you do it? Are you out there most of the day?
When I first retired, I would disappear probably 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, not come back in until 6, just trying to figure things out. But that's really probably too long to spend at a hobby that requires, time and patience. So I could spend 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours out there easily, as long as I've got a project that's being worked and things like that. So the other thing that I would recommend for folks that have been interested and have never really gotten into it is see if there's a woodworking shop or a class or a course that might be offered. That's really how I got some of the skills and learned to do certain things, was taking a woodworking class here in Greenville, South Carolina. I've done two now, and this particular class actually lets you work on a piece of furniture so that when you're done, you walk out of the class with a piece of furniture like this coffee table that I just finished. So,
yeah, just like shop class.
Yep, absolutely.
The pride of...
And the other thing that's neat about it, too, is guys that go or girls that go to this... woodshop class, I mean, you become friends with them, and you figure out, you meet new people, and it's just a good way to socialize as well.
Phil Smith talking about what it is to be a retired guy now. You know what? This program's gotten funny, and I've been criticized, and I'll paraphrase the criticism. Hey, Mac, your friends are all falling apart. They're all going to the VA getting surgery, and you guys are now the sick, lame, and crazy brigade. And today we're talking about woodworking and retiring. No, you know, hobbies are, let me tell you. So you're doing woodworking, good exercise for the brain?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in a different way. And one of the ways that I found that I'm not necessarily good at woodworking is designing a piece of furniture. In other words, sketching it out and making it look like a piece of furniture on paper so that you can get the measurements and things like that. I am not good at that. So I always have to work from somebody else's plan and those types of things. And guys that are good at design, I think they would find great joy and satisfaction and be able to design a piece of furniture and then actually make it. That's where the guys really see a lot of, completion and, the art and the science of, a skill, kind of coming together.
Holy smokes. Listen, that's it. What's the favorite thing that you made?
Well, actually, I think the first thing that I made, was my big wood, workbench. And it's the favorite thing that I've made just because it's big. I used, some scrap material, follow the plan, but it has really, come in handy. I mean, you've got to have a nice large, workbench so that you can do, your projects on it. And, I think that's probably the favorite piece right now. Although, the three tables that I've made, a sofa table and then these two coffee tables, they're the projects that, make you focus on jointry, and edging, and finishing, to the degree that I hadn't focused on it before.
My guest, Phil Smith here on a Wednesday edition of, All Marine Radio. In terms of giving people advice about hobbies, how did you obviously had background, in wood and were familiar with it. Was it an easy choice for you? Was it something that you did? When we were at the basic school, one of our guys named John Carper used to carve ducks. And waterfowl. His specialty was Maryland shorebirds. And he would go take pictures, or he'd get a picture out of a book. And Carper was, he's an infantry guy, so he's a knuckle dragger. But he had this artistic side to him. He had this craft side to him. And he would make these birds. I got a duck that's really ugly, but he made another shorebird that was beautiful. And some of the complex stuff he did was very cool. When did you start doing it?
Well, I think I actually started doing it while I was there at the TBS and IOC. We bought a house in Stafford and didn't have an outdoor shed and it had an unfinished basement. So my project the whole time that I was there at IOC at home and on weekends was building an outdoor shed and then finishing the downstairs basement, two bedrooms and a utility room and a hallway. So that was really the first thing that I've really tried to do. I've built bookshelves for the kids occasionally out of pine and just very simple joinery. We still have some of those bookshelves around, but like I said, those projects there in were something that I had to do just because of storage, and it was a small workshop as well where I kept a couple of saws out there, but it never really put to use any skills on jointery and fine art of finishing a work until I retired and come out here.
All right. Email question for you. Woodworking. Mac, I'm a huge woodworker. And a question for Phil, does he anticipate him growing this into maybe something professional, or is this strictly a hobby? A lot of guys grow. I remember interviewing a guy. I wish I could remember his name. He's Italian. And he started making tools for breaching of homes when he was a cop. Owns a business
cool.
Now. Owns a business now. Yeah, it was lightweight axe so that you could access the house if you had to. And, it wasn't the big, Home Depot axe. It was something that was, maybe half the size and the materials were different and had a claw on it. Things that would be unique that would come in handy when you're trying to smash somebody's house in. It evolved very naturally. Would you be opposed to doing it for a living?
I'm not opposed to it. The thought has crossed my mind several times about how I would approach it because woodworkers typically and normally don't make particularly if they make furniture from scratch. They don't make a lot of money. They put their their heart and their soul and their time into it for a small return of finances. But I had thought about it, and I thought about how I would get into actually doing it. I had thought that the ability to repair furniture is something that there's a market for. So I could see myself, letting this skill develop to a point where I can actually repair furniture, grow up a clientele here in the local area, people that know about the shop, and then eventually start making furniture for that that clientele. That might be something that I would do, but I just don't think that I've got the skills put together quite yet to do that. But.
All right, spoken with great humility. Text message question. Ask Phil about the piece of shit Ford truck he had at 1-7, and I saw around the entire 1-7 CP. And again, what kind of guy buys a red truck? Okay, so explain the red truck, first of all. Red is the color of a chick vehicle, okay? So you're a guy, so you have to explain that. And then explain, obviously, somebody else is put off by the mere presence of that piece of garbage, in or around the early 1990s. So get correct. What happened?
Yeah. Well, I bought that truck as a student at Texas A&M. I was a MESEPer, so, nobody was going to give me shit about my red truck at Texas A&M, being a Marine, but I bought it, 2 years old, and it actually had, it was a perfect red, cherry red, and it had chrome wheels on it. I took the chrome wheels on it, off of it, and put stock wheels back on it just because I didn't like that much of a shiny edge to it. But and I had that truck until right before my command time down at 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines. Actually, as a director of IOC, I put it in the ditch and broke the axle on it, and that's when it was kind of out to lunch. But anyway,
Let's hear about that. How did you do that? That's a that's a rookie move, and it's not like you'd never driven the trails of Quantico either.
Oh,
so,
yeah, and it's not like I didn't know the roads in the backyard upshore either.
Right. So what happened?
Well, we were finished with an exercise. Actually, it was at an upshore. I think it was the mount exercise or something that we were doing. Coming back from that, it was 11:30 or midnight, and I reached down to turn the radio on or change the channel or something. My eyes left the road, and I just happened to be on a long curve. And the truck kept going straight and went to the ditch, hit the curb coming out, and it bent the frame. The cab came off. Fortunately, one of the instructors from IOC was behind me. Mac, let's see, what was his name? Not you, Mac, the other Mac.
There is no other, just so you know.
Yeah, there was. But anyway, he came along, got me to the gas station and took a look at the motor, bent out the fan blade so it wouldn't hit on the side of the truck and drove it home.
You drove it home. Nice. The you know, that is in the old days. I don't know if they still do it. I imagine they do, but in the old days you a lot of times, you know, you were doing one problem and then you were needed on the other side of base. So you were in your vehicle. And so, you know, sometimes another instructor with you. General Paul Kennedy, Major General Paul Kennedy, he's a first lieutenant, I think, at the time. And we're rolling around and we're going to go do a reconnaissance on a Friday afternoon after we got done doing some problem of a problem that we were doing. I think it was a movement to contact problem. And so we wanted to make a couple changes to it. So we're going to go. So you drive down these trails in Quantico that have been there forever and we get to a stream. Now, sometimes during the year, they're intermittent streams. Sometimes they're straight up streams. This one was in between and we looked at the map like, well, we can get across here. And I have a brand new black Pathfinder. Okay. And I stop and I said, I don't think we can make it across there. And he looks at me and he says, buddy, if you don't drive across that, you don't have a testicle in your body. I said, really? So 30 seconds later, we're high centered in the middle of this creek in my new truck. in my new Pathfinder. And I look at him, and he says, "Buddy, who knew? I didn't know." No? So now we have to get out. We have to, no cell phones, right? We have to walk to some woman's house that, you know, out on by MCB9 or some crazy thing out on the edge of the frontier. We knock on her door. We have the old kind of cami paint on your face, which came out of this metal tube. And once you scratch it on your face, you know, you had to get like Brillo pads to scrub that crap out of your face.
Yeah, right?
and then you'd hear guys scream when they're putting it on, and then the thing kind of slid back into his lipstick holder, but the lipstick holder was straight up metal. So they'd be like trying to put it on quick, and all of a sudden you hear this, "Ah!" Like, yeah, you got to shove that out from the back end, bro. And anyway, so we knock on the door, and she looks, and we're like, "Ma'am, we're really sorry to bother you, but our vehicle broke down. Could we borrow your phone?" She handed her phone out the door to us. And, you know, the story gets even better. Gets even better because here's the deal. We called a tow truck, right? And, you know, in rural Virginia, you meet an interesting group of people. Okay. Some of them are Beltway people. Some of them is not. Right. I remember that one day, Mike's wife called me. She said, "Michael, I might need you to come home." I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Well, the guys from the air conditioning are here and they've got, you know, there's those, they got the ponytail southern guy and they keep calling me girl. Hey girl, can you go? She said, "I'm just a little bit nervous." I said, "They're probably, you know, are they missing some teeth?" She said, "Yes." I said, "They're just good old boys. They're redneck." I said, "But if you want me to come home, I will." She said, "Not yet, but hey, girl, go do that from California, no less." So anyway, this guy shows up, and he's part of the good old, he's a good old boy, and he's got, he pulls up in the tow truck. Kennedy and I hop in, and I see he's got a 38. Kennedy's like a first lieutenant, so I make him sit in the middle, of course. And so on the bench seat, he's got a 38 sitting there on the bench seat. And we hop in, and we're like, "Hey, what's that?" And like, you know, you never know what you run into out here. So we're driving down to get my truck, and I said, "Hey, who knows you're out here?" He goes, no. I mean, they just dispatched me from the station I work at. I said, "Do they know if you're here?" He said, "No." I said, "How much is this going to cost me?" He said, "Well, $80. I said, "How much of the 80 do you get?" He said, "No, I don't get any. I just get paid my hourly rate." I said, "Okay, how about this? You pull me out. I got to go get money out of an ATM, right? I'll pay you $40 cash and tell them that you didn't find us." Right? He looks at me and says, "All right." So Kennedy looks at me and goes, "That was awesome. That was awesome." But, But it's to break your axle, that's a rookie move. And then you had to, you know, put the truck to bed. That had to, hurt, huh? You'd had that truck forever.
Yeah, I actually, at the chagrin of my lovely wife, I towed it to Camp Lejeune thinking that I was going to have time to work on it. So it sat at the house out there in Jacksonville for a few months, and then my wife decided that it was sitting out there too long, and she said, "Get rid of it." So took it down to a local junkyard, and they gave me $75 for it.
That hurts. The disrespect of the disrespect of the junk dealer. All right. Hey, I'll give you a call and come back on next week, and we'll talk. I want to get your thoughts on what we're doing in Syria, North Korea. So do a little reading, and we'll have you back on and talk. But we could talk woodshop.
Sure.
We could talk woodshop anytime. People like it, and we could talk about your red truck too.
Absolutely.
That's obviously a fan favorite. All right, Smitty. Thanks for the visit.
Sure enough. Take care, buddy.
Bye, bud. That is the one and only Phil Smith. This hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the one and only Battle Mug, which starts as a 10-pound block of aluminum after it's milled, machined, and anodized, ready for you to make your own. Picatinny rails make it unique, one of a number of products that they make that have those. Each mug has a serial number, so you know it's designed to be for military guys because it's got a number. You can know that it's yours, and you can have it engraved. Perfect gift for any commemorative event. Promotion, farewell, retirement, birthdays, anniversaries, get out of jail stuff. You know what I mean. Check the whole product line out at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battlemug is a veteran-owned and operated company made entirely in the United States. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Rob Schwartz, Montana Man, is going to join us on a Wednesday. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.